You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
Hello, folks, and welcome to PyReps. PyReps is a show dedicated to educating, informing, and piquing the interests of the flying public, student pilots, new private pilots, and anyone interested in the world of general and commercial aviation. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of PyReps. I'm Private Pilot Phil, and with me is First Officer Brian Johnson. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Phil. How you doing?
Welcome back from that flu bug.
I had it bad.
You feeling better?
Much better.
All right. And today we're going to be discussing conquering maneuvers. And since you're a flight instructor, you'll be able to explain some of these maneuvers to us and why students have to perform them and such. All right?
Sounds good.
Now, the first thing I actually wanted to talk about, because I've noticed just talking to student pilots around at the airports and whatnot, they only seem to know two types of aerodynamic stalls in their training, and that's the departure stall or power on stall, and the power off stall, which is approach to landing stall. And never do they ever mention accelerated stalls to me. Now, I was demonstrated when I was a student pilot what an accelerated stall is. And to me, I think an accelerated stall is a little more, has a little more danger element to it, because an accelerated stall is a stall that you can have an overbanking in a turn, that kind of thing. If you're taking people up for a ride and you want to look at their house and you're flying around it and you overbank, or if you're in the traffic pattern and you overbank if you overshoot the runway, can you explain accelerated stalls to us and what the dangers are?
Well, first, I think we need to step back and just explain what an actual stall is.
Okay.
Just in case we have someone who doesn't know. So when we talk about stalls, we're not talking about the same type of stall you might think about in a car. If your car stalls, the engine stops. In an airplane, the engine can stop. It's rare, but possible. But stalls have nothing to do with the engines. Stalls have to do with the wings. So the wings need a certain amount of air flowing over them at a certain angle in order to generate the lift necessary to sustain the aircraft in flight. And anytime that lift is disrupted and that angle gets too large, the aircraft stalls. Now, aircraft are designed to be, most aircraft are naturally designed to be stall resistant. So usually as long as the pilot doesn't try to counteract it, most airplanes will recover on their own. But the problem is newer pilots or inexperienced pilots don't always know that. And it can even catch experienced pilots off guard as well. So the operative word with a stall is angle of attack. Angle of attack is the angle between the what's called the relative wind and the chord of the airplane's wing. So basically it's the angle that the airplane's wing is at as it moves through the air, the angle at which it hits the air, I guess is a better word.
So let's take a Cessna 152 or a Cessna 172, which a lot of student pilots are probably practicing in now. Mm-hmm. That pitch is right around 18 to 20 degrees nose pitch.
Yeah, so exactly. Nose pitch is, if you take an airplane and you look at it from a side profile and you draw a line straight from the tip of the airplane in the front all the way to the tip in the back, that line along that axis called the longitudinal axis is what we're talking about when we talk about pitch. Now, if you tilt the airplane up or down and it changes the angle of the airplane, if you can think about it like balancing on a teeter-totter or a seesaw, as the front of the airplane points up, that's called increasing the pitch or increasing that angle. And as it points down, it's called decreasing the pitch or decreasing the angle. Now, because the wing is attached to the airplane, you're also changing the angle of the wing as well as it moves through the air. So keep this in mind. An airplane doesn't always fly exactly where it's pointed. It doesn't have traction like a car would have on the ground. So when you're on the ground in your car, because your tires have traction, whatever way you point the tires, that's where the car is going to go.
Correct.
But an airplane's moving in a fluid of air, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
It's moving in an ocean of air, I guess is a better word. So it can drift sideways. It doesn't always fly and go exactly where it's pointed.
Sort of like on ice.
You can think of it like that.
Yeah.
Yep. So For example, you can have the airplane pointed relatively high at a high pitch and still be moving downward in a descent to a lower altitude. You can have the airplane pointed sideways. This is another topic, talking about yaw, but you can have the airplane pointed sideways and moving straight ahead. It's not as simple as in a car. So I guess to rein it back in, because I feel like I'm rambling a little bit, when you talk about pitch and angle of attack, as that angle gets too high, the airplane wings stall because you need air flowing smoothly over the wings in order to generate lift. And the air can only take such an angle. As that angle gets too big, the air no longer flows smoothly.
As you pitch up, the airspeed also slows down over top of the wings. That's what we discuss. Airspeed is critical as well.
Yeah. But keep in mind, I always tell my students, airspeed is critical, but it's not the most important.
Okay.
Any stall, and this is mainly semantics, but this is the way I like to teach it. Power off stalls and power on stalls, or some people call them departure stalls and approach to landing stalls, whatever you want to call it. A stall is a stall. There are different configurations that the aircraft can be in, different phases of flight in which the stalls are common, but all stalls are fundamentally the same and all have fundamentally the same cause and the same remedy. So no matter whether you're in a takeoff configuration or you're preparing to land or you're doing maneuvers over your buddy's house, like you mentioned, any stall always happens when you exceed what's called the critical angle of attack. So like you said, that airplane's wing was designed to fly at a maximum angle. For most small Cessnas and Pipers, it's going to be about 16, 18 degrees nose up pitch.
Yep.
Once that angle is exceeded, the airplane's wing will stall.
Yes.
And it'll continue to stall until the pilot lowers the angle or allows the airplane, under certain circumstances, to lower the angle on its own.
And also to mention, we do have, for those that are just starting out and haven't done stalls yet, we do have what's known as a stall horn in the airplane. It will kind of, it will tell you of an imminent stall, and it'll actually go off before you stall, so you can actually release that control pressure and avoid a stall once that the horn goes off.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So, we're 18 to 20 degrees pitch. So now we're going to talk about move into accelerated stalls, which will be in a turning situation. Let's say, like I said, going over a friend's house, we'll use as an example. You're over the friend's house and you're a little bit excited, you know, you want them to see their house. So you're going to keep increasing the bank as you turn over this house, kind of like turns around a point. And you're not realizing it because you want them to get a good picture or whatever they want to do. Maybe take a photo of their house and you're increasing that bank angle. But as you increase the bank angle, the airplane's going to want to descend. So in order to counter that, you have to pitch the airplane. You want to pitch the airplane to maintain altitude. And if you overdo it a little bit too much, that's where the problem comes in, especially in a turn and you're in a steeper bank. Mm-hmm. For example, like let's say you get up to a 40-degree bank. In a Cessna 172, your stall speed's going to increase to about 56 knots. And if you're not used to that, you're used to seeing it maybe at, 49 knots or whatever it is in the straight and, like a departure stall or something. But you're increasing that bank, so the stall speed is going to increase, and it might catch you off guard. And you're saying, I'm at 56 knots, I'm okay. And then all of a sudden, there goes the stall horn.
Yeah. And that's the difference between an accelerated stall and one of the normal, if you want to call it that, approach or departure stalls. In accelerated stalls, the operative word is accelerated. What's being accelerated is the G-force.
All right.
So normally, I like to make it simple by breaking it down into mathematical terms. And for anyone who's not math savvy, just bear with me. Like I promise it'll be fairly easy. let's say, just to make the math easy, let's say you're flying in an airplane fully loaded that weighs 1,000 pounds, okay? Well, if your airplane weighs 1,000 pounds, gravity is trying to push your airplane down to the earth with 1,000 pounds of force. That's 1G. That means that your wings for your aircraft have to constantly generate 1,000 pounds of lift to counteract the 1,000 pounds of the force of the weight of the aircraft. So gravity is trying to push you down 1,000 pounds. The wings have to counteract that and generate 1,000 pounds of lift under 1G. But anytime you take a turn in an airplane or even in a car, we've all taken corners in a car really fast or on a roller coaster, and inertia wants to keep you moving in the same direction and you feel heavier. Well, as you feel heavier, the airplane also feels heavier. So absolutely. Without getting into too many details, it's like it tricks the airplane into thinking that it's heavier. Mm-hmm. And so if you are in a 60-degree bank, for example, a 60-degree bank is 2 Gs if you're level and coordinated. So in normal flight where you're just moving straight ahead, you're generating 1G. But if you make a 60-degree bank turn, the airplane's going to experience 2 Gs.
We're carrying 2 Gs, so we'll be twice our weight.
You're going to feel twice your weight. The airplane's going to feel twice its weight. So if the airplane feels like it's 2,000 pounds, the wings have to generate 2,000 pounds of lift in order to counteract that. Well, the only way to generate more lift without increasing airspeed is to increase your angle of attack.
Okay? Right, to maintain altitude.
To maintain altitude. So that's why, like you said, you have to pull back on the elevator controller.
Now, we're talking 60-degree bank, which is technically aerobatic. Okay.
Yeah, it's right at the board, yeah.
And so, again, we have the stall speed increasing. Mm-hmm. So at a 60-degree bank in a Cessna 172, that stall speed would increase to about approximately 70 knots.
Okay.
Right around in there. So that could really throw a pilot off.
Yeah. And the reason why the stall speed increases is because in an airplane, there are only two ways you can generate more lift. The engineers design the wing within certain structural bounds. You can't change... barring talking about flaps and other high lift devices, generally speaking, you can't change the engineering of the wing. So the wing is the wing. It's only designed to generate so much lift. And the only way to increase the effectiveness of the wing's ability to generate lift is to either speed up so that you're hitting more air molecules to create more lift, or increase the angle of attack so that the wing is hitting the air at a broader angle to hit more air molecules.
To maintain altitude. So accelerated, we're in a potential accelerated stall.
Mm-hmm.
And we're increasing that. We'll take 40-degree turn, 40-degree
okay.
bank.
Okay.
60 degrees, you might end up in a 60-degree turn if you're not, bank if you're not careful. But at 56 knots stall speed, now... tell me, in an accelerated stall, what is it, a higher percentage of entering an aggravated stall condition with auto rotation because you're in a turn?
Potentially.
Okay.
Not necessarily.
Or in a bank, I should say.
Really, whether or not you're getting into spin territory. Whether or not
right.
the airplane has a tendency to spin depends somewhat on the design characteristics of the airplane. Some airplanes are more spin prone than others.
Right.
In fact, some have reputations for being spin prone and others have reputations for not being spin prone. So like, for example, not to disparage any particular makes and models, but the Piper Tomahawk comes to mind.
Okay.
A nickname people gave it was the Tomahawk because it's very spin prone, really easy to spin if you're not careful. But I've flown and instructed students in a Diamond Katana. And that airplane is very spin averse. It's like really hard to get it to spin. Like you have to force it into a spin.
That's kind of a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So really docile trainer. So it depends a little bit on that, but it also mostly depends on pilot technique. Because remember, a stall is just, it occurs when you exceed the critical angle of attack. An accelerated stall is a normal stall when you exceed the critical angle of attack while you're flying in a condition at more than 1G.
Okay.
That's what's accelerating.
Or in a turn.
G-force. In any curving flight, anytime you're not in straight flight, whether you're curving, another way of saying turning.
Or in an abrupt pull-up?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. You can be pulling out of a dive. It
gotcha.
Doesn't necessarily have to be a turn. Anytime you're in curving flight,
okay.
then you're going to be at more than 1G. Unless like you're maybe climbing and you do an abrupt pitch down,
okay.
then you'd be at negative G's in that case. So that's a little bit different. But anytime you're turning or pulling out of a dive or any combination, you're going to be at more than 1G. You can imagine you're going to feel heavier. That can put you in accelerated stall territory. Now, if the airplane's perfectly coordinated, remember how I talked about before how the airplane may not exactly fly where it's pointed. If the airplane's coordinated and it is flying exactly where it's pointed, Then the airplane, again, depending on the design characteristics, should stall. And as it stalls, it's going to pitch down straight ahead towards the center of the Earth. But if it's uncoordinated, then that's when you're going to have an imbalance in the lift being produced by the wings. Typically, one wing is going to produce more lift than the other, depending on, again, the pilot technique. And then the airplane enters the auto rotation.
Yeah.
The incipient spin phase.
And sometimes it just happens out of nowhere really fast.
Unexpectedly.
Yeah.
The pilot's not anticipating it.
Catch you off guard.
Yeah.
So we've explained accelerated stalls, which is, that's what I wanted you to do, because these students just don't, I don't know what it is. They haven't been trained for accelerated stalls, or just don't know what they are. You know, mm-hmm. My instructor put me into an imminent accelerated stall a couple of times to get an idea, because he wanted me to know what the circumstance was, and that it's different than the departure stalls or the, you know, approach to landing stalls. So, mm-hmm. And so that really helped me out. So I don't overbank or anything like that. You know, I learned not to overbank in the pattern. If I overshot the runway, I'd just go around, mm-hmm. that kind of thing, rather than take the risk,
yeah.
you know. So,
good
and
idea.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I guess we'll get into some ground reference maneuvers,
okay.
Which I haven't done in umpteen years. So I guess we've got turns around the point. If you could explain that to us. I think I've done that a few times as a student. Once you get to be a private pilot, you kind of don't do it anymore, so you kind of lose that skill. But explain a ground reference maneuver, turns around a point.
Sure. So all turns around a point, or rather all ground reference maneuvers, are designed to help the pilot learn how to compensate for the effect of wind on the airplane. Because just like I said, if you've been a ground-bound creature your whole life up to the point of your pilot training, if you've been driving cars, again, you're used to the car going where the tires point. But because the airplane's moving in air, that's not always necessarily the case. So you have to learn how to compensate for the effect of the wind on the airplane in order to get it to go exactly where you want it to go. So turns around a point are one of the ground reference maneuvers that we practice to help a pilot develop that skill.
Oh, one other thing that I forgot to bring up before we do any maneuver, clearing turns.
Yes.
That's part of the FAA regs, if you want to explain that real quick before we go back to ground reference.
Yes. Clearing turns are extremely important. In the air, we fly as student pilots under what's called visual flight rules, or VFR. So it's all see and avoid. There are no stop signs, no traffic lights, no yield, no lanes, none of that stuff. The way we keep ourselves separated, more or less, is just by using our good old-fashioned eyeballs.
Right.
So anytime you're going to be doing anytime you're flying and you're not in the clouds, you need to be looking outside primarily to look for other aircraft, to see where you're going, make sure you're not hitting terrain or obstructions or getting too close to another airplane. And that is especially important anytime we're going to be doing maneuvers where we're changing our direction and things like that very fast. So anytime you do a maneuver, it's always best to do clearing turns. The FAA does not really mandate exactly how you do it, as long as you scan the full 360-degree circle of the horizon. So some pilots do two 90-degree turns where they'll do a 90-degree turn, stop, look behind them, and do another 90-degree turn. Some people will do a 180. Some people will just do a full 360-degree turn.
Yeah.
Doesn't really matter. Whatever floats your boat, just as long as you scan that entire horizon before you do it.
That's a good safety thing for us to all do. Plus, it's a reg too. So,
not a reg necessarily. It's a good operating practice.
Okay, sounds good. So now we'll talk about the turns around a point. I interrupted, so I'll let you continue.
No problem. The clearing turns are important. That's the law of primacy. You got to teach it right the first time. So with turns around a point, the object is to fly relatively low above the ground, usually about 1,000 feet above the ground, which is a standard traffic pattern altitude, and find a prominent landmark. It can be a tree in the middle of a field. It can be a radio tower. It can be an intersection of two roads, just something that's distinct and visible. And then you want to go and about a quarter to a half mile away, you want to fly a perfect circle as best you can around that object. Now, as your direction changes, the wind direction in relation to your airplane is going to change as well. So let's say you normally start what we call going downwind.
Tailwind?
Yeah, with the wind at your back. So that's called downwind with a tailwind. So the wind's pushing you. You may be indicating on your airspeed indicator, let's say 90 knots, typical flying speed or maneuvering speed in a small Cessna or Piper, for example. And you're doing this at 90 knots. But because, let's say, if you have a 10-knot tailwind, if the wind is moving from behind at 10 knots, your airspeed indicator is going to indicate 90 knots. But you're
your
actually
ground speed
doing
is going to be faster.
Yeah. You have to add the speed of the airplane through the air to the speed of the airplane with the air, which in that case, if it's 90 knots through the air plus 10 knots with the air, it's 100 knots.
Right.
Which means that as you pass that landmark off the side of your wing, you're going to be departing from it fairly quickly.
Right.
So you have to start your turn a little more aggressively, for lack of a better word, a steeper bank turn in order to keep from shooting past it. Because otherwise, instead of being a perfect circle, your turn's going to be more of an egg shape. If you take a bird's eye view and you look down at the maneuver you just flew, it's going to be more of an egg shape. When you're downwind, the wind's going to blow you farther out from the point. And then when you're upwind, when you're facing into the wind, if you're still doing 90 knots and that you had that 10 knot tailwind before, when you're facing into the wind,
now you got a little headwind.
Now you got a headwind. So now you're doing 70 knots of ground speed. So now your turn is going to be closer to the landmark. So if you can kind of picture in your mind's eye a landmark and kind of an egg shape or an ellipse around the landmark, that's what you're going to fly if you don't vary your rate of turn in order to compensate for the wind.
Yeah, if you keep it too tight from the tailwind to the headwind, you might get too close to the object.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, so you want to decrease the bank angle as you're going into the wind, since it's going to slow you down a little bit.
And that's why we always start downwind as well, in order to keep you from having to increase the bank angle too much. Because let's say you start upwind. Let's say you start with a headwind, the wind at your front, and you enter into a medium bank turn, which is about 30 degrees or so. Typically, for most flying, we're not going to bank the airplane past 40 or 45 degrees. There's usually unless you're doing some kind of evasive maneuver, there's usually not a reason to turn the airplane that sharply. So let's say you're heading upwind with a headwind around this landmark, and you start off with a medium bank turn. Well, because your ground speed is slow, your turn rate needs to be slow relative to when you're downwind. Now, when you have the wind at your back, if you started upwind with a bank of 30 degrees, in order to keep that same radius and make that circle perfect, you might have to exceed 40 or 45 degrees or more in order to keep from getting blown out too far. And that's potentially dangerous, especially to a low-time student pilot.
Yeah.
And that relates to accelerated stalls.
Right.
If you're not careful.
And that the slower... Are we necessarily going to slower airspeeds at that point? I mean, because we're not in pattern. We don't have flap extension.
No, we usually do them. The speed is not as important. The way I always taught it, and most other instructors I know teach it, is to do it at a comfortable cruise speed. So in a small Cessna, like let's say a Cessna 152 or 172, like 80 to 90 knots, you can slow it. If you want to make it more realistic to traffic pattern operations, you can slow down to your approach speed. But in order to do that, you're going to have to add flaps. Typically, we do it at about 80 to 90 knots in a small trainer aircraft.
Sounds awesome to me. I remember those days. I just don't remember all the maneuvers and how to do them. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just been that long.
Yeah.
We'll go into S-turns along a road.
Okay.
Those were always fun because they were actually a little more challenging than turns around a point.
Mm-hmm.
If you can explain that.
Mm-hmm. So S-turns across a road are very similar to turns around a point. But if, again, take in your mind's eye, take that bird's eye view of you making a circle around that tree or that intersection, cut that circle in half and stretch it out, and now you've got an S-turn along a road. So in this case, you fly the maneuver in almost an identical configuration, so about 1,000 feet above the ground. You find a long, straight landmark of several miles, preferably, whether it's a straight fence line or a road or a railroad track or something like that. And now, instead of just turning in one direction in a circle multiple times, now you're going to make S's across that road. And this just like turns around a point, sharpens your skills in correcting for wind drift, but now you have to do it in both directions. So instead of just having if you're doing a turnaround a point where let's say the landmark is off your left, which typically it will be, you're just making a constant turn in one direction to the left. Well, now for an S turn, you cross the road with the tail at your back. You start an immediate turn in one direction, let's say usually to the left. And then as you come back around 180 degrees and cross the road, you're going to have to go wings level and start an immediate turn to the right and do a 180 to the right. And so you're constantly alternating your turning direction. Yeah. You want to keep the S's on both sides of the road the same radius. So you don't want to have one really wide turn on the downwind side and one really really big half circle, I should say, on the downwind side,
yeah,
and a small half circle on the upwind side. You want to keep the radii of your circles constant and consistent.
So I remember those. Those were a lot of fun.
Yeah,
especially kind of just timing when to go wings level.
Mm-hmm.
It was always fun to do that.
Yeah.
And so, what about now? These maneuvers. Are these more like low level, lower altitude maneuvers? So what altitude are we looking at, like mean sea level on the altimeter with these? I know we're supposed to stay above 600 to 1,000 feet AGL, but if you could explain what the MSL would be on the altimeter, because what happens is our ground level is different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I guess we have to add to the MSL or something like that, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So the MSL, there is no standard MSL. The MSL is going to vary. MSL stands for mean sea level. There are different types of altitude. Well, there's really altitude is altitude, but there are different ways to define altitude. You can define altitude in terms of your height above the mean ocean level, mean sea level. You can define it in terms of height above the ground. So let's say if we live in the Detroit area, and Detroit is approximately 700 feet, 600 to 700 feet above sea level. Well, when you're on the ground, if your altimeter is calibrated properly, it's going to read 700 feet MSL, even though you're on the ground. Now, if you fly 1,000 feet above the ground, now in the Detroit area, your altimeter is going to read 1,700 feet above sea level, MSL.
Right.
But you can also define altitude in terms of height above the ground, which in that case, you're going to be 1,000 feet above ground level, or AGL. Now, because the terrain varies across the United States, the FAA doesn't mandate an MSL altitude. They can't tell you, well, you have to be at 1,000 feet above sea level because, well, in, let's say, Florida, for example, that might work. But in Denver, you're going to be in the ground, basically.
Yeah.
So they always mandate an AGL altitude to say, well, based on the terrain where you're at, you have to be a certain height AGL above ground level.
See, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so typically for most maneuvers, ground reference maneuvers being an exception, you want to be able to complete the maneuver at least 1,500 feet above ground level.
So 1,500 AGL, not MSL.
Correct.
Okay,
and when you're,
it makes sense.
When you're referencing, so you'll have to do the math in your head to know, okay, what is the elevation of the terrain over which I'm flying? And then add at least 1,500 feet to that.
And we can get that information from sectional charts.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we're doing, so the S turns along the road, so right around 1,700, we went over that. Those were so fun. I can just remember those. I just keep thinking about how fun and challenging it was.
I like them.
For me. Yeah, absolutely. And then, mm-hmm. They're not as scary as stalls were for me. I'll tell you, in the beginnings of it,
mm-hmm.
But all of these maneuvers that we're talking about, as you move on in your flight training, you'll get used to them, you'll get to know them, and you'll get comfortable with them. Mm-hmm. You won't be so nervous about it after you've done it a few times, because you'll just get your confidence levels up. And that's what a lot of these maneuvers are for, to pick up confidence.
Mm-hmm.
For a student pilot working his or her way towards the private pilot.
Sure.
So let's move on to, we've covered ground reference maneuvers. Let's talk a little bit. I don't know if this is a category of maneuvers, but we do perform maneuvers in this situation, the traffic pattern.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few maneuvers that we talk about, but we want to emphasize in traffic patterns, usually the standard pattern is left turn, left traffic.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some some airports that have right traffic. Just real quickly, and we'll get back into maneuvers, how do we determine if it's left or right traffic for a particular airport?
Well, this is one where there is an FAA mandate.
So okay.
The FAA has mandated that unless otherwise published, all traffic patterns are to the left. So
okay.
A traffic pattern, again, because we don't have stop signs and traffic lights in the air, a traffic pattern is a standardized orderly flow around an airport. So when you're taking off from an airport to go off someplace, maybe out to the countryside or to a different airport, there's an orderly flow and an orderly manner for leaving the airspace around the airport. And when you come back to that airport or arrive at whatever your destination airport is, there's an orderly flow of traffic for getting into that airport. And it's just a common understanding between all pilots that everybody's going to follow this orderly flow, so you can kind of get yourself in line. Kind of like taking a roundabout on the road, okay? In a roundabout, there's no traffic light, but there are certain rules of the road that you have to follow.
Correct.
So you know that, okay, well, you yield to everybody on the left. Well, in the traffic pattern, every pilot follows that flow. And if you're looking outside and you can see other aircraft, depending on where they are in that traffic pattern, you know who to yield to, who has the right of way, et cetera. So typically, just like in a roundabout where you yield to the person on your left, and if you're looking at a roundabout from up top, it's usually going to be counterclockwise in the United States, counterclockwise flow. If you're looking at it from top down, a roundabout's going to go counterclockwise. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So a traffic pattern is, if you look at it from the top down, is also going to be counterclockwise. It's going to be a square, but it's going to be counterclockwise because everybody's making turns to the left. Now, the FAA, in some cases, does mandate that you make turns to the right. And in those cases, that'll be published in some publication. So it can be published in the chart supplement, which is a document that gives you information about an airport.
Okay.
And a few other places as well. So I say mandate because the FAA mandates that the standard direction of turns is left, but it's still really... Actually, you know what? I don't even think they do mandate it. I don't think it's a regulation anywhere. I can't think of a regulation in the federal aviation regulations where it mandates they all must be to the left, but that's another best
practice. It's a common practice.
Yeah, it's best practice. That's
because that way that's going to prevent any kind of collisions.
Yeah, that's in the, now that I'm thinking about it, in the Aeronautical Information Manual.
Okay.
Aeronautical Information Manual, which is, I mean, you can think of it almost like regulation, but it doesn't carry the exact weight of regulation.
Gotcha.
So, yeah.
And so we're going to move on. We're going to stay in the traffic pattern a minute because there's a couple maneuvers that we really don't practice out in the practice area that we use in the traffic pattern. Mm-hmm. So I'll go over a couple of those and you can explain those. The first one I have is S turns on final.
Okay.
If I remember correctly, if we've got an airplane in front of us landing and we're a little bit tight, we'll do S turns in order to give that aircraft in front of us some room to land so we're not right on top of them. Am I correct?
That's correct, yeah.
So how do we perform the S turn on final? Because I've only done, I think, twice in my, you know, private pilot career.
Mm-hmm. The same way you do any other maneuver. Now, the purpose of doing S-turns across the road is not necessarily to prepare you for doing S-turns on final. And with S-turns on final, you're not really as concerned about wind drift because you're still ultimately pointing at the runway. That's where you're trying to go. But S-turns are a way of spacing yourself out. If you move in a straight line, you're going to cover more distance in a given unit of time than if you move in an S-pattern.
Okay.
Because now you're covering more distance. You're taking longer to get where you want to go. We'll put it like that.
It's almost like it's almost kind of like rather than slow down to a critical low airspeed for the aircraft in front of you, doing the S turns will kind of slow you down. Kind of, I don't know.
Yeah, it's just saying. Like let's say you're driving.
It's
your
a
car.
Sense you are slowing down, but you're not slowing down.
Yeah,
you're giving room to the aircraft in front of you.
Aircraft can't stop. Helicopters can, but aircraft can't hover in air. Like I've mentioned before, we need a constant flow of air over the wings in order to generate lift. So we can't stop. Now, if we need to be placed in a specific point in space and not move, air traffic control can put us in a holding pattern.
Okay.
But if we're trying to space ourselves out, if the aircraft in front of us is moving slower, or if we just need to slow down to give ourselves more space, we can only slow down so much without stalling. So the only way to do that, or one of the best ways to do that, is for S-turns.
So essentially, it's spacing.
Yeah, it's for spacing. I've done it in my private pilot career. I've done it in the jet. I remember one time going into New York's LaGuardia. The weather was great. They were clearing us for visual approaches. Air traffic control gave us a really tight turn behind this other jet ahead of us. And they were on short final for the runway 22. They turned us in too close behind them. And so we were both looking like, I don't know if we're going to make this. So rather than go around, which would have been a viable option as well, we decided to do S turns to space ourselves out. And it ended up working out.
And it also avoids wake.
Yeah, that too. Yeah,
absolutely.
Can.
Mm-hmm. So the other two maneuvers I want to talk about in traffic pattern is, we're going with forward slips and side slips.
Okay.
And they're both slips, but they're used for slightly different things. If you want to explain that.
Sure. So a slip is the technical name for, when the airplane is flying in a different direction laterally than what it's pointed. So like, let's say, for example, normally if you stand in front of an airplane or stand directly behind an airplane and look at it flying through the air, it's going to be pointed directly where it's flying. But there are certain cases where the airplane can fly kind of sideways. That's called a slip. Now, normally that's not a good thing, because a slip, when the airplane's flying sideways, it increases the side profile of the airplane and increases wind resistance, which increases drag. So it makes the airplane have to work harder, which is what you don't want to do. But sometimes that can be beneficial. Let's say if you're coming in to land and you've got too much altitude and you need to lose altitude, but you don't want to descend too fast because that's not good. You can put the airplane intentionally into a slip and fly it sideways. That's going to increase the drag, almost acting like a big parachute, to help the airplane descend more rapidly without gaining a bunch of extra airspeed.
So if we're coming in, let's say we turn final and we're coming in a little bit high.
Yeah.
A forward slip is what we'd use in order to increase the descent rate to kind of make up for being too high on final.
Yes, it's one of the corrective maneuvers in the pilot's toolkit for doing that.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. Adding flaps is another one. Like you said, S-turns is another one. S-turns can help space you out, but it can also help you descend as well, because with S-turns, you have to cover more distance. So again, if you can only descend if you're too high and you don't have enough distance to dissipate all that altitude, well, one way of doing it is doing the S-turns, because you're still going to be descending during the turns, and now you're just covering more distance over the ground to still get you to that altitude that you need to be at over the runway. So that's another one. Extending flaps are another one, because flaps will help you increase your lift and drag. And
yeah,
your descent
and
rate,
drag, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And increase your descent rate as well, without decreasing your airspeed too much. But last but not least, forward slips are another method of doing that as well. Now, the funny thing about slips is you've got the two basic types: forward slips and side slips.
Right.
The forward slip is primarily an altitude dissipation tool. You use it to,
and you know they used to use that for airplanes that didn't have flaps.
Yeah, back in the olden days. Yep. Yeah, a lot of old classic airplanes were built without flaps, so it's like you were always slipping to lose altitude. So that's one type of slip. The other type of slip is called a side slip. Side slips are primarily useful for a different purpose, because again, if you're landing and you have a wind from the side, the airplane's moving forward, but the wind's also going to be pushing it sideways. Now, you don't want to land sideways, because that's going to put a lot of stress on the tires and the airframe. You want to land... You want to land the airplane pointed straight ahead. You want the wheels to be in line with the runway.
Center line.
When it touches down. So the way to do that is to kind of, for lack of a better word, trick the airplane into turning without actually turning. So normally when you...
Good way to put it.
When you bank the wings, when you move the ailerons to dip the airplane and turn it into the wind, the airplane wants to actually turn. If you're flying coordinated, you use the ailerons and the rudder to dip the wings and actually turn the airplane in that direction. But if you dip the wings into the wind with the ailerons, but then also step on the opposite rudder to keep the airplane pointed straight ahead, now the airplane's going to kind of, you can imagine it kind of falling into the wind, but it's still pointed straight at the runway.
Center line.
And it's falling.
So it's not going to drift.
It's not going to drift because as it's falling into the wind is also counteracting it, pushing it the other way. And so the net effect is that if you're doing it right, it should stay lined up straight over the runway, still pointed straight ahead. And that may be kind of hard to visualize without actually flying or actually seeing it, but hopefully that makes sense.
So another thing that kind of fits into that, I have a question for you, an additional question.
Yeah.
The Cessna 172s, I don't know about the 152s, but in the airplane it says, do not perform slips with flap extended.
Mm-hmm.
What is the reason for that? And is there, can we still slip it with minimal flaps?
You know, I used to know, but it's been so long, I forgot the reason, and I don't want to quote one on air.
Okay.
In the interest of being incorrect.
I mean, don't feel bad, because it always confused me as well.
Yeah.
Because I know some people do perform slips with full flaps in 172s.
Yeah.
But I always...
I think in certain models, and again, my memory, this is years ago. I think in certain models of the 172, when it was being flight tested, with full flaps extended, it disrupted the airflow over the rudder, over the tail.
Okay.
So it made the rudder less effective full flaps in. So it just made it a little more precarious to fly at low speeds, close to the ground.
Okay.
Which is typically when you'd be doing forward slips.
Right.
So in order to mitigate that, then they put that placard in. And made the rule.
It's fascinating. And one more thing on landings. Mm-hmm. A lot of students are, even out at, say, Pontiac Airport.
Yeah.
These youngsters they have a 6,000-foot runway in front of them. Mm-hmm. And they're still using full flaps on landing. Mm-hmm. And every time I mention to them that, you know, you can do a zero-flap landing, they get this anxious look in their eyes because some of them haven't been trained to do zero flap landings. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to say that you can do zero flap landings. You just come in at about, in a Cessna 172, about 70 knots. And if you have a long enough runway, you can achieve it. And the airplane won't be as squirrely without those flaps, if you can explain.
Yeah, so you can definitely land with no flaps. Pilots are creatures of habit, generally.
Right.
So the way we've learned how to do it, the way we're most comfortable doing it, is the way we tend to, that's just human nature. But a good instructor will train their student and have them practice no flap landings or flapless landings, whatever you want to call it. Now, one purpose of flaps is to help you increase your descent rate, another way to put it, I guess, is reduce your speed while still maintaining a safe margin above stall. And reducing your speed is beneficial because if you're touching down at a slower speed, that means you have less energy to dissipate. It's going to take you less distance to land. It's going to put less wear and tear on the brakes and on the other components of the airplane to get you stopped safely. So we want to land our airplanes as slow as possible. It's good for the airplanes, and it's also it can help get us more utility out of the airplane because we can get into shorter airstrips. Now, with flaps, you can reduce your landing speed. Without flaps, the airplane will still fly, but you just don't have the added benefit of the extra stall protection, so you have to approach at a faster speed. Now, that faster speed just means that your pitch attitude, the angle that the front of the airplane is pointed, is going to vary. It's going to be somewhat higher in this case than if you were approaching with flaps. Your touchdown speed is going to be faster. The airplane is going to be a lot more responsive. The airplane's landing rollout is going to be longer. It's going to take up more distance. You're going to have to dissipate more energy. So the mechanics of it are a little bit different, but the fundamentals are the same.
Absolutely. It's just fascinating. I was taught no flap landings late in my, when I was a private pilot, actually,
mm-hmm.
never as a student. And I started to enjoy no flap landings.
Yeah.
Because the airplane wasn't as squirrely. Everything was smoother.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just had to come in about 70 knots in the 172.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So a real brief, if you could just briefly go in, we're going to talk about crabbing into the wind on final, and then we'll go to the next maneuver. It's a common practice. If we don't want to really slip the airplane for a crosswind, we can crab it. Am I correct?
Yeah. So crabbing is pilot slang for intentionally pointing the aircraft into the wind to compensate for the wind. So it's one of those things that you'd learn during some of the ground reference maneuvers, primarily during rectangular courses. We didn't talk about that one specifically, but with rectangular courses, you're learning how to effectively crab the airplane. That term comes from, if you've ever seen a crab walk sideways,
yeah,
they look kind of funny when they walk. Well, that's where the term comes from. So you're intentionally, the airplane's flying coordinated. You're not necessarily holding the controls sideways or out of neutral. You just point the aircraft consciously into the wind and allow the wind to offset that compensation to keep you pointed where you want to go. Kind of like if you're swimming across a river and you've got a current pushing you sideways, you kind of have to swim a little bit into the current in order to get you from point A to point B.
Keep it going in a straight line.
Yeah, otherwise, you're going to drift downstream, you know.
Right.
So that's what the airplane does, or that's what the pilot does, rather, consciously to keep the airplane pointed exactly where they want it to go.
In particular, like the major airlines, the bigger airplanes, because they, mm-hmm. a couple of the airline pilots that I talked to told me they don't like to really slip the big ones, especially the ones with the engine on the wings.
Yeah, I was going to say, a lot of them you can't, because depending on the wingspan and where the engine placement is, you really can't slip them as effectively. A small Cessna's got a relatively short wingspan. The wings are up high at the
Absolutely.
Top. So you've got more ground clearance between the wingtips and the ground than you would in a modern jetliner, where you've got the engines hanging on the bottom of the wings, and the wings have a longer span, so you can't slip as much as you can in a Cessna.
Right.
In the CRJ that I fly, we can do a max of about 11 degrees of slip.
Okay.
Which sounds like a lot, but it's really not a lot. I mean, if you can imagine an 11 degree angle, it's really not a whole lot.
So it might not be adequate for a real strong crosswind.
Yeah, but here's the thing about jets. Well, not really jets. It affects jets because jets fly fast. But here's the thing about speed and wind. The amount of slip or crab that you need, or particularly crab in this case, is not only dependent on the wind, but it's also dependent on the speed as well. So if you, I guess a simple way to explain it is, if you're moving at, let's say, 100 miles an hour, and the wind is moving, you know, you've got a direct crosswind and it's moving at 10 miles an hour. Well, over 100 miles, if you were to travel 100 miles straight ahead, or pointed straight ahead without any compensation, after 1 hour, you're going to be 10 miles off course. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because you're moving 100 miles an hour. So in an hour, you're going to move 100 miles, but you've got a wind pushing you 10 miles to the side. So you're going to be 10 miles off course.
That gets you in a little bit of trouble.
Yeah.
Navigationally.
Mm-hmm. Which is why you have to crab. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, let's say you're doing 200 miles an hour. Okay. An hour, you're going to be 200 miles ahead of where you were before, but you're still only going to be 10 miles off course.
Okay.
So the angle, the amount, even though the speed is still the same, the amount that the wind is drifting you is not as much. So another way to put it is, if you're doing 100 miles an hour, after an hour, you're going to be 10 miles off course.
Gotcha.
If you're doing 200 miles an hour, once you cover that same 100 miles, you're going to cover that same 100 miles in half an hour now, because you're going twice as fast. So you're only going to be 5 miles off course.
Oh, so you're going to lose less mileage, or be less off course.
Less off course per unit of time. So
gotcha.
At 200 miles an hour with a 10 mile an hour crosswind, you're only 5 miles off course as opposed to 10 miles off course.
I'll take the 100. Five.
Yeah, so that's a kind of a somewhat complicated way of explaining that. The faster you're moving through the air, the less of the effect the wind has on your course. So that's not to say that faster flying airplanes don't have to compensate. We still do. In fact, we crab on final just like anybody else. But the effect is not as pronounced, because in a Cessna 152 or 172, you're flying an approach at, what, 65 knots, 70 knots, like
right.
I said. In the RJ, we're typically approaching at anywhere from 130 to about 145 knots. So we're
just
doing
a tad faster.
Yeah, twice as fast. So like I said, in a given unit of time, that same tailwind that's going to be, or excuse me, same crosswind that's going to feel like a lot to you is going to only be about half as strong for us.
Oh, I see.
You know?
Oh, that's good then.
Yeah, same wind, but because we're moving a lot faster, it has a less of an effect.
The next thing I want to talk about is the one that always got me was what always got me a little bit airsick, to be honest, when I was a student. Mm-hmm. Because when I was getting ready for my second check ride, my flight instructor wanted to make it twice as hard as the check ride would be.
Okay.
So we were doing unusual attitudes under the hood. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's when you put the hood on and you put your head down and you look at your lap, and the flight instructor is doing all these maneuvers to get your inner ear all confused. Mm-hmm. And you're supposed to look up and look at the instruments, not look outside and figure out what attitudes the airplane is in and recover. Mm-hmm. So he was really torquing some G's on me, and I got airsick. But you know what? I looked up and I recovered that airplane. Good and thing. I did not tell him that I got sick. So go ahead and explain unusual attitudes under the hood for us.
Yeah, sure. So all pilots have to have at least some basic training in how to control the aircraft just by looking at the instruments. So this goes against what I said before. We're always looking outside, generally speaking. But in this case, let's say you get distracted and you inadvertently fly into a cloud. Well, now you can't see where you're going. So in order to keep the airplane right side up, you've got to just look at the instruments. So unusual attitude recoveries teach you how to recover the airplane to a safe state in case you get disoriented. Human beings, we're designed or evolved, whatever, however you want to call it, to be ground-based. So we've got these structures in our inner ear that we use for our orientation. When you move your head, the fluids in your inner ear move, and the sensory input to your brain tells you what your body orientation
yes.
is, whether you're right side up or upside down. And that works fantastically on the ground. But the problem is when you're in the air, and again, you're potentially moving sideways and your pitch attitude is changing and all the other things we've been talking about, your inner ear is not reliable.
Right.
Now, the thing is, when you can see the horizon, your inner ear still is out of whack, but you trust your eyes more.
Right. Exactly.
So you can look outside and see with your eyes what your orientation is and kind of ignore your ear. But when you don't have the reference to the horizon, your inner ear would kind of screw with you.
Absolutely.
And so this is actually killed many a pilot who
on a serious note it has.
Yeah, who've gotten disoriented, maybe into the clouds, for example, and instead of trusting the instruments which were designed, if you know how to interpret them, to tell you what the orientation of the aircraft is, will ignore the instruments, trust their ear, which is lying to them, and the result is often not good.
And this condition is which was actually what I was going to talk to you about, but you've explained it. Mm-hmm. It's known as spatial disorientation.
Exactly, yeah. We've all been spatially disoriented before. I remember, you know, I've got a 15-month-old son, and he loves when I spin him around and drop him on the floor, and he feels dizzy and stuff like that. Well, that's spatial disorientation, you know. When you've been spun around and you stand up on your feet, well, the problem is the fluid in your ear is still moving.
Yeah.
All out of whack, so you feel dizzy, right?
Right.
Well, in an airplane, again, you might not be spinning in a circle, but because you're not stationary on the ground,
you're pretty darn nauseous.
Yeah, it can get you nauseous, and it's the same phenomenon. And so if you are, you know, when your feet are planted on the ground, you can, even though the fluid in your ear is still moving around, you know you're planted on the ground. So again, you can trust your, you know, your orientation.
Yes.
But in the air, when you don't have that reference, it can be dangerous if you don't know how to trust the instrument. So
in particular, if you're in clouds.
Yeah.
Because I remember I was on a instrument flight with you.
I remember that.
Okay. Yeah. And we were were we flying towards the Salem VOR?
We were. Mm-hmm.
And I thought we were
in a
right bank.
And we were in a left bank.
We were in a left bank.
Yep.
You got me.
Yeah. And you were like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm turning. You're like, wait, what? So case in point.
Yeah, why are we in a right bank?
You know? Yeah, yeah. So,
and we were in clouds at that time.
We were in clouds, exactly. So in order to prepare the pilot for that, as instructors, we simulate those conditions purposely just to get a student used to it by the slang is called putting you under the hood. So in aviation, we have these view limiting devices, and they vary. It can be like a special pair of glasses where the top of the glasses are frosted, so you can only you've got a very narrow field of vision. You can only see the instrument panel, or it can be a literal hood that you put over that restricts your vision so you can't see outside. But whatever it is, being under the hood is any type of view limiting device that restricts your vision to inside of the flight deck. Now, you can still probably move your head and cheat a little bit, but that defeats the purpose. So just like you said, we put you under the hood. And as the instructor, we're going to torque the airplane. We're going to put it in turns and, you know, step on the rudder to get you all disoriented on purpose, because we want to simulate exactly what it's going to feel like when you're in the clouds and you're maybe making turns and doing maneuvers because you're not sure what orientation the airplane is in. And the purpose is to get you used to that and teach you how to, when you come to and realize, wait, I think I'm disoriented, quickly and correctly interpret the instruments and know the procedures to return the airplane to a safe state.
That's tough to do.
Yeah.
When you're in that state mm-hmm. of disorientation, you can go into a panic.
Yeah.
You literally mm-hmm. can, especially, I understand the, you know, just doing the simulation. Mm-hmm. But in the simulation, VFR, if you get in trouble, you can just look up.
Yeah.
And there, you can get oriented again. But in the mm-hmm. clouds, you can't do that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a completely different monster, and like you said, it has killed many a pilot. Mm-hmm.
Because you can't trust your body, and it's very hard
not to try.
It's easy, you know. we're sitting around a table here talking about it, so it's easy for us to talk about it. But when you're in the airplane and you can't see, and like you said, your body's just telling you, "I'm in a right bank. I just feel like I'm in a right bank."
Right.
It's hard to trust your instruments over what your body is telling you, but unless you know you have some type of malfunction, which we train for how to recognize instrument malfunctions as well. So, barring an instrument malfunction, you have to trust the instruments over your body when you're in that scenario.
In the last episode, I was talking about how I had a gyro fail on me mm-hmm. Going into Hillsdale. difference was it was VFR that okay. day, so I could use pilotage to yeah. get out of it. Mm-hmm. Or I had ATC actually give me a no gyro approach
cool.
into Hillsdale, and then they gave me no gyro back to Willow Run, which I really didn't need because it was VFR. Mm-hmm. But if you have that issue in clouds, you could be in a little bit of a pickle.
Yeah.
You know, yep. Especially if your ear is playing games with you. Mm-hmm. You know, that's going to cover the maneuvers for today. We got about 3 minutes left. But the next episode, we'll get into some turns. Okay. We'll just kind of continue off of and then get into another topic. But news events.
Okay.
We're going to news events. My pet peeve, First Officer Brian, is drones. I think they're a danger to aircraft and a big hazard. And it's just a matter of time before they cause a major accident, if you could kind of.
Yeah, they are. I don't think they're necessarily inherently dangerous, but the problem is, and generally I'm not a fan of overregulation, but they're hard to regulate because, sure, you can have commercial drone operators who dot all the I's and cross the T's, and they know the regulations about where they can fly their drones and when they can fly them and how high they have to or how low they have to be and how far from airports. But any amateur hobbyist or any kid can go to the mall or Amazon and purchase a drone.
That's disturbing.
Yeah, and fly that drone and not know the rules. And the FAA, unless you're going to put a, you know, an FAA representative in everybody's household, it's just very hard to police. So I like to hope that, you know, the problem will work itself out, but it is increasingly becoming more and more of a problem. We've had drone sightings. We've seen drones. Thankfully, I've never hit a drone, but there have been aircraft that have reportedly hit drones, or at least think they've hit drones.
Well, you know, they're worse than bird strikes.
Mm-hmm.
They can do a heck of a lot more damage, especially to a wing or a critical area of the airplane. Yeah. And gosh forbid not, you know, run into the window of the cockpit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of thing, because that'd be real bad.
Yeah.
So I did it. I think an airport close down because of a drone threat?
Yeah, I think it was
recently in the news.
London Gatwick for okay. a couple days, just before Christmas, I think. A couple days before Christmas, there was a drone flying unauthorized in the airspace. And so for safety reasons, they shut down the airspace for a couple days. And I forget what came of it, but I know it disrupted holiday travel, cost the airlines and the airport millions of dollars, and it was a big fiasco. But
And it was for safety reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's better to cost them money than an airplane or lives.
Exactly. You know? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, and I do have a couple of friends who are drone owners who are not pilots, and they tell me their stories all the time, and I just kind of cringe, and I say, "Oh yeah, drone." When they mention drone, I cringe.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I've got my drone license as well. There is, if you want to be official.
Yeah, but you know the regs.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what I was going to say. Learn the regs. They're not hard. There aren't that many. If you're going to do it seriously, do it seriously. I mean, get the training, learn the regs. You can take the training for free in many cases if you want to go and look it up online. It'll make the airspace a lot safer for everybody.
Sounds good to me. We're going to wrap it up, folks. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Pi Reps.